to the Comedy Fix podcast. We have been on a series of small breaks, and I imagine that's given us time to pause, think, reflect. You know, one thing about doing, you know, basically 63 consecutive episodes is that it almost feels like you run out of things to talk about. I know I was feeling like, oh, do I have anything more to say on the subject? Now that it's been a couple weeks, I have more to say. I just had to recharge my batteries. I'm here with Chris and Sam, as always. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, no problem. And one thing I've been observing lately is, you know, I've gotten back into teaching. You know, I'm taking an improv class taught by Chris. That's really fun. But when I teach students, I try to get them to, like, and Sam and I, you and I have worked on this, speaking, you know, extemporaneously, like basically letting your mouth go faster than your brain can keep up. And I push myself to do that just to see what's there. And I always feel disappointed. So I don't know, like, and some people, it really unlocks a lot of good stuff. But like when I do it, I feel like the audience is uninterested and I also am not satisfied. I don't know. Maybe it's not for everybody. Sam, what do you think? You and I have done a lot of work in that regard.
Yeah, it's something that I struggle with because I have a quick moving brain, I think, and so I can often be in front of my words. But when I try to let the words get out of my mouth faster than my brain can get a hold of them, I often make nonsensical meaning that doesn't really have anything behind it, but just kind of develops into this thing. And there are times when I can go on a rant on a topic, and I think it can be really enjoyable. There are other times where I might feel like I'm not really saying anything. So I don't know. I think I've seen improvisers get themselves into trouble by doing it. And so I think it can be a really powerful skill, maybe just one that I need to work on more. I don't know, Chris, are there exercises? Do you train? Is this what you do on your own?
It's funny that you say that because I had two thoughts. One, I thought that would be a great exercise. Just go, right? No thinking. I love that idea. A little scarier for performance, but if anybody could do it, you two could do. And as I thought about that, Sam, I thought, are there muscles that we can build up to be better improvisers? I think quickly people might say yes, but then I would kind of challenge that. I don't know. You know, oftentimes students or non-improviser people tend to think that being a good improviser means you're fast, quick-witted, fast on your feet, fast on your toes. I don't feel particularly fast on my toes, to be honest. I don't know. That's interesting. What can we train? What muscles can we train to be better at that? Or, and I think this is where I'm kind of where I've been lately, and it's very experimental, is more of like kind of doing training who you are. That's a weird sentence. Like, you know, who you are as a person and bringing that on stage versus the tools versus different tools needed for performance, if that makes any sense. I mean, yes, there's projection and there's clarity and there's opening yourself up to the audience, but like, I don't know, these like other tools, what do we work on, guys, to be better?
I've deployed a few tools with students I've had, and one is it's a specificity exercise. Just two people do a scene and then I'm constantly on them, more specific, give me three examples, what, you know, and I just push them for things that they weren't going to access in their brain, they had already moved on. You know, I'm getting a few things from the store, and then the scene keeps going. I'm like, okay, well, name the first five things on the list. And so then they have to kind of access that specificity. I think that gets them in that kind of space. That's the kind of muscle I'm talking about. Or there's that classic short form game, New Choice. That's kind of in that same realm, you know, where for those of you who don't know it, you're doing a scene and some, you know, the teacher or whatever says New Choice, and you have to take back the line you just said and finish it a different way. You know, I'm going to have dinner with the mayor, New Choice. I'm going to have dinner with my mom, New Choice. I'm going to have dinner with the dead, you know, and hopefully you access some of that stuff that wasn't on your brain in the first place. So those are a few different exercises. But when I do that with myself, I just feel unsatisfied.
Jimmy, my question is, and yes, I want to hear about you being unsatisfied. And I apologize for jumping in. But my question is, and maybe Sam, who's the smartest of the three of us, can answer this. Is there a neurological, you know, part of, I can't, you know, I'm the dumbest of the three, of our brain that we're talking about when you say like this new choice stuff? Is it something you can strengthen in the brain, a part of the brain, or is it again strengthening, like maybe you not judging yourself or like allowing yourself to just say things without judgment? You know what I'm saying? Like, is there an actual, you know, they say like to help with like Alzheimer's or dementia, like do crossword puzzles. Like, is there an actual scientific part of the brain, Sam, that we can work? Is there an elasticity there that we're working?
I mean, I'm not a neuro
yes,
scientist.
You are.
My loose understanding would be something to the effect of, you know, we have different aspects to our brain, right? We have analytical, we have generative, we have conscious, we have subconscious. And I think what a lot of these things are trying to do is to get us away from that analytical conscious brain and tap into that sort of like generative subconscious. And I've done it before. I don't know that I could do it on command, where I am so in a flow that I really can sort of make sense as I speak and things get away from me. It's actually something that like a lot of genre improv will talk about, that if you get in the mind space of the genre, you can kind of let it carry you in some ways. But I do think that there is something. It's so funny you mentioned the listing sequence, because that's actually worked for me pretty well, especially once you get into like a ridiculous number, you know, once you're into like 15 items, like you're tapping into stuff you just never would have thought of if you sat down and thought about it.
I've seen you two do like in a scene, but it's also like a short form exercise or format called like simultaneous lectures, where you two will just turn to the house, to the audience, and keep talking. Do you know what I'm saying? Like keeping your own point of view about what it is you're saying. You're both going at the same time. That was pretty fun and pretty cool to watch. And I think in a situation like that, you're kind of getting ahead of yourself. That's kind of fun. And then also what's hitting us, the audience, is both of your words at the same time. It's also kind of a fun experience. Mm-hmm. Also, you know, I might've mentioned this in the podcast, but one of the most eye-opening experiences I ever had as a teacher was when I taught at UCLA Business School, Anderson. And how funny that the specific topic we were teaching was how to be better at second round interviews, especially because I'd never even been on a first round interview. And what they were saying was, and I know I've said this before, but just hear me out, that the data shows that these students crush a first round interview. They do all the research on the companies they're going to interview for. They know a lot about what they're talking about there. And they say the second round is where the wheels come off. That was their words, which I thought was interesting, where it's the stuff you can't prepare for, the questions you can't have the answers, you can't have studied for. And that's where they brought us in to kind of lead them through some exercises to kind of get them out of the comfort zone. And I'd say the number one thing I learned here was what we're talking about right now, which is these students are all very bright at a very prestigious business school and have done well academically. Holy shit, was it hard for them to turn that off? Was it hard for them just to say something in gibberish? I mean, it was painful for some of them. Just say gibberish. They would freeze so, so hard. And really, that experience really taught me something. Like, oh, because sometimes, you know, I often think I'm, you know, I have an inferiority issue here. And I thought, like, you know what? I guess all these years of being up in front of people making stuff up is a skill. I knew it is a skill, but I don't know. In front of these people that I was kind of intimidated of, I had to wear a tie and like, oh, these are like smart people, and they couldn't say two lines in gibberish. It was really interesting.
You know, it sort of makes me think of athletics, and when you see those athletes who are just, right, we talk about they're in the zone, right? They're doing moves that you can't train your body to do. They're just, they have the mental thought of, I need to get to there for the ball, or whatever it is to make that incredible kind of athletic play. And like, that to me is where great improvisers can go, right? They can let go so much so that they're in the moment, that they're ascending to a height that we couldn't have imagined before. I think that's really hard to get to. And I think there have to be, you know, a lot of things firing on all cylinders for people to kind of get there. But I think that's one of the things that these conversations kind of revolve around, is like, how can we get more people into that kind of space?
Yeah.
Sam, you and I are going to do the specificity scene, and Chris is going to be on us to be more specific. Okay. I think this is one of those where we just need to put it on its feet and then maybe explore it from the inside. Okay. Does that make sense, everybody?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah.
Chris, will you give us just the most random suggestion you can think of?
Sure. Newspaper.
Wow. It says right here that the Dodgers were winning the first time since the Groundhog
right
Day.
It says
right here on the third page, line 2, exposition 4. See that footnote down there in the small 2-point? I got my microphone out so I could read it aloud to you, as I also got my binoculars out so that I could see it. Magnifying glass broke. Dog spit on it, and I couldn't find the towel. Can you read that for me, Sam?
Yeah, I brought my microscope, so that's no problem. It says what under kind? There... It's a Dewey 55 microscope from the Heimberger company in Germany. They make the best microscopes in the world.
Yeah, so they do. They were the ones who gave me my diagnosis. I had mononucleosis, and they saw that one nucleosis right in the middle of the monologue.
Yeah, by the way, I really am glad that you're in remission on that. That was such good news when me and Caroline found out, because, you know, we've been your best friends for 24 years.
Who's
since
Caroline?
We met in college, and Caroline and I started dating in the first week after she got in the sorority and I got into the fraternity, Delta Tau Alpha. And ever since then, we've been best friends.
I've been best friends. Hey, you know what? Caroline, before she was best friends with you, she was best friends with my sister. My sister is a raging alcoholic. You know, she slams pipes like I slam smokes. You know what I'm saying? Like I burned my toe one time on a cigarette because I was trying to put it out. I had so
what
many
kind of
in my hand. Marlboro Lights. Yeah, they were burning so fast. I had 4 in each paw. You know, and so one time one dropped on the cement, bounced right off the concrete, slapped down on my ankle, burned, singed the hairs right off. And that's what actually led me to go to the doctor to get that mononucleosis diagnosis. I'm in remission, admission, and submission.
Well, you know what? All 4 of us better be going to a Dodger game sometime, because I swear, if you, your sister, Caroline, and I don't get together before too long, you're going to have another cancer scare and we're going to be in trouble then. You know what I mean?
Oh my gosh, what's your experience in there, guys?
You know, well, Sam, you go first. I already talked about.
You know, it can feel awkward at times, like you're tripping over your words, but there are the moments where if you tap into the rhythm and you just say something, it can be really fun. I don't know how it is for the audience, but it can be fun for me as a performer.
Yeah, there's moments where it's fun and like I enjoy what come out, what I just like the nonsense that I just said. And then there's other times where I'm like, I don't know. I was disappointed with like, oh, that's all I had. Like I'm like, I'm totally at my wit's end. And like all I could come up with Marlboro Lights. It's just like, yeah. I don't know. I guess. So I don't know. Maybe that's just a little bit of self-judgment.
I think so. For us, it feels very satisfying. Also, I was anxious the entire time. My stomach was kind of in knots. I was tight. I was tense. I was scared that you were like not going to make it. Quote, like, I don't know, not make what. Like I would say, you know, give me more. And like you wouldn't be able to. That's really interesting. Also, do you think, because, you know, we should do a whole episode on warm-ups. Because I've kind of gotten rid of warm-ups as a teacher and as a coach, which might not be a great idea. But I wonder, do you think something like this, then almost like putting the lead ring on the bat before you go to bat when you're off to the side practicing and you take it off and it feels, you know, the bat feels lighter. Do you think something like this equates to that? You know, you could go on stage and maybe have more words about you or less judgment?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I mean, it certainly gets me into more of like a playful headspace. And I'm I probably would not want to put that on its feet for an audience, but certainly as like a warm-up thing, like that's a lot of fun. And if you can bring a little bit of that into a show, yeah.
But do you think that it's actually preparing you? Is it like stretching before you run?
Yeah, it's, you know, working out with weights, just like you said, putting that lead ring on to make it a little bit harder. It's, and I do think you have to balance it, because I think you can't always do the one hard skill. I was practicing like like sonnets for a while and like alternating rhymes, but I could never integrate it into the show because I was always just sort of practicing that on its own thing. And I wasn't doing it like with other people in the moment kind of thing. So you have to balance that training a little bit.
Interesting.
Yeah. I think getting in that amped energy space, and it, you know, it's one of those exercises where you can't really do it slowly, because then your brain will always be ahead of your word. So you almost have to have that high energy rat-a-tat kind of pace. And I think that does help kind of warm you up, get you in more, like a Sam said, like a more playful space, more of a silly space, which, you know, if that's, I think that's a good energy to be able to tap into. But again, you wouldn't want to see a whole show like that. It'd be exhausting to watch. But Jamie, even a whole scene like that is exhausting.
But Jamie, I'm not talking like even more specific. Oh, we're talking about specificity. Even more specifically, do you think that there's like something, if you do this as an exercise, would it set up somebody for more success, as stretching might be for somebody who's doing track? Like, you know what I mean? Is there an actual literal connection, do you think? And I know we're hypothesizing here, but between like doing something like this and maybe now you're on stage and you're a little looser, like do you think that there's an actual application? You know what I'm saying?
I do think so. I mean, and I think, and I observe this in the class that you teach and I'm a student in, is that some people need help breaking out and some people are already broken out and just need help channeling. So it's one of those exercises where it might be good for people who need help breaking out, but someone who's already broken out and is already loose and ready to go, it's like, God, this is okay. This is easy for them. This is just like a jog.
That's a really nice way to put that. I always think about the people who need help breaking out lately, but right, what about those who have broken out and need help channeling? That's really interesting. Since Jamie's been in my class, Sam, I've always thought I don't want to bring it up too much in the podcast. You know, not too much, because first of all, we miss you like crazy. But there are, you know, some things that are just kind of interesting that I think would be interesting for everybody. We did something last week where we started off with my favorite type of stuff, slow, grounded scenes, and then went to the other extreme and was just, we just had to be as wacky as possible, which I've never really done, Sam. It seems like a very basic improv exercise, like, you know, be crazy. And I just don't spend a lot of time there. And it was really interesting to see what happened. It was really interesting. And then we did a piece after that, a little montage. And some of the moves that were made in the piece were a little sillier and more whimsical. And some of the students said they felt that they had warmed up when they were doing the wacky stuff. It put them in a position or a place to like have that wackiness in the show, which might not have been there had we not done that, which I rarely do. Also, Jamie was great in that, you know, I'm like, do whatever, you know, be crazy. And it's funny, like Jamie just said, some people need help cracking open, because some people's extreme goofballness was not extreme, was just going like, I'm hungry. Or, you know what I mean? Like there's nothing, was nothing. Meanwhile, Jamie went up there and like fish hooked himself or something and ran around stage going, but he doesn't need help cracking open. It's all, this is just, it's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I was definitely one of those people who, when like asked to show like a 9 or a 10, people be like, no, bring it up. Like that you're at a 5, like you got to give us more. And I think there's, you know, there's also this idea of anchoring, where like, if you like in price negotiation or whatever, like if you put a number out there, like you're going to end up closer to that because you're kind of anchored to it. And I think that's sort of what this warm-up stuff might be doing too. We're like, okay, now I'm in a headspace where I'm going to try to do a lot of specifics, right? That's not just like a warm-up for like general, but like that's a very specific kind of thing. Same thing with like the big energy, right? I think that can be a great kind of warm up. I'm just real quick, Jamie kind of said, and I'm curious, do you think you can only do it fast? is there a slow version of this sort of tapping into your subconscious?
Oh, I thought there was more to that question. Tapping into the subconscious?
Well, you know, your point was you kind of have to do those scenes fast because we're really trying to get ahead of our brain. And I'm just wondering, are there other ways that we can shut off our brain but not have to do it at that speed?
I don't know. I think because the mechanism that's operating in the mind is the control mechanism. So you would have to have some way to set that aside, to block it, to overcome it, to mute it. Speed is one way to let go of control. Something's happening so fast that you can't control it. Maybe something, I haven't thought this through, maybe like something to music, because you can't control the music. So if the music guides what you're doing, now you can't be in control. Maybe there's something like that, some kind of external guiding force that allows you to give up control. But I think that control mechanism is what's at play here.
Or is this also sort of the physicality, right? When people tell you to get like physically invested in a scene, you're sort of doing one thing while talking about another, and maybe you're also sort of disrupting the control a little bit.
I thought about that example too, Sam. When we do that in class, I'm always surprised to find that students have a hard time doing both, washing the dishes while talking about doing taxes. That's a hard skill. That's very interesting. I mean, and then it's like, well, how much control do we want to give up? On any given day, I could be like, you know, be present as much as you can. Just listen, and you're in the moment, and you're not thinking. But then I go open play, and I can see seven moves ahead of me. I can see a little thing I want to plant or a piece of information I'm going to use later, and that's in my back pocket. And, you know, it's really interesting. I did two shows last Monday, Sam, on stage at the West Side, our first ever, like, coming back. And the first show I did was with people that I don't typically play with. Chris Corbos was there. I play with him occasionally. And the second show was Heyday. And in both of, so it's two different shows, obviously. And in both of those shows, I found myself a little bit struggling with also coming to grips with how I want to play versus how the team plays. And I don't know, there's just a lot going on. There's just a lot going on in there. I don't have a specific point except that, like, control, the idea of control, letting go of control is nice, but also don't we have to have, you know, an eye on the piece or know where we are in time, and we need control for that or control for the edit. And it's just a lot of moving parts. A lot of moving parts. I don't know.
Yeah, that's interesting to also think that you might be a creative director on one team and you are in kind of control of the vision of that team. And on the other hand, you might be sort of a guest performer on a team and you have really no control over what's going on. It's kind of interesting, like, what the experience is playing in those two different shows, because in the one where you're just kind of going along with it, I wonder if there's a different sense of play, I would think. But at the same time, it might not be what you want to do. I don't know.
You know, I was in a two-person scene on Monday, and I made it a point that I really wanted to connect. So we're doing this like date scene and I'm really going hard on the emotion and stuff. But we didn't say that before the show. We weren't like, let's do a very emotional show. It's just, hey, let's go play. We'll see what happens. And my scene partner, she's great. She just wasn't in that mindset, as most comedy improvisers probably aren't looking to start crying on stage. And I felt I had to bail. I had to kind of bail on that. I felt this wasn't being accepted. And I don't mean that against her. I really don't. I had my own motivation, my own goals. And I was like, oh, this isn't the scene and this isn't the show. So then I'm out there kind of like almost wishy-washy, almost like, I don't know, you know, I can make the moves. And that's another thing too. You find out some of this is riding a bike. I was on autopilot for some of those moments, if I'm being honest. All three of us could get up on a stage and really phone in the show and it would be just fine. for better or worse. Not that I was phoning in, but like, I don't know. I don't even know what I'm talking about. Just very interesting to have spoken. Like Jamie said, 63 consecutive episodes and all my workshops I've been doing, and then being out there was a different experience.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, also just sort of thinking about what you unconsciously bring into the show, right? Like, I'm always working so much on my own self-awareness and how am I feeling and how can I not fight that in the show tonight, right? How can I use how I'm feeling in the show tonight? And yes. Then there are all the other people you're playing with and how they're feeling coming into the show.
I'm wondering how this relates to something Sam, you and I have been working on and still talking about control. And a lot of times in improv scenes, it seems like it's always under control. And I think that makes it, I don't know, boring or cheap or something, like, you know, I don't know. I don't even know what my thought is. It's always acting. It's pretend. Oh, you know, I don't know. You left me and now I'm heartbroken. It's like, well, that's not real, you know? So there's no real like control. There's no real breaking of the control mechanism, but something Sam and I have been working on is how can we employ and utilize actual real things that we may not be able to control. Like Sam and I were talking about, maybe we would do a show where at the beginning of the show, he would drink a gallon of water and like actually drink a gallon of water. And then he would not be able to leave to use the restroom. And so like he has to pee and we are doing the show. That urgency, that sense of having to pee makes him lose control of the situation a little bit. And that's not a great example, but the point is like, how can we use real things to lose real control on stage, to have real moments of improvisation? Because as long as we can control everything, I don't think the improv will be as pithy or as juicy. It's like the scene where he's holding the table above his head. He's genuinely losing control of that table. That wasn't fake. He was genuinely losing it. And that lack of control made it scary. It made it real. And so there's something there. I don't know exactly what I'm articulating, but I don't know. I'm just kind of rambling. You guys have thoughts on that?
Yeah. I mean, what's so interesting about it is if you think about capital I improv shows, right? It's a very controlled environment. We're saying it's Harold Knight. There's the stage, there's the audience, there's very much like a fourth wall kind of a thing that doesn't get broken. And so, you know, comedy lends itself to chaotic energy. And so the more that we follow that controlled version, I think the less we're able to have what you're sort of going for, which is when we're really improvising and the audience might take over some of this control. And actually, I think short form seeds this a little bit with what they do, and Chris, maybe you can speak to that because you know that world a little bit better. But I think that's one of the reasons why short form is really popular, is because it does go crazy. The performers aren't in complete control, and there's a lot of value you can get out of that. I don't know. What do you think, Chris?
I think you're right. I have hesitation with the idea of a long form show without control from an audience perspective, because I've heard the criticisms of people who go to see shows who aren't improvisers. They say, I'm anxious the whole time. I'm worried they're not going to be funny. I'm worried they're not going to do it right. Where are they going? They feel weird. So if there was even less of at least an idea of control up there, that might, I don't know who wants to watch that.
You know, maybe it's good to differentiate the two concepts, because one is, do you have control over the stage? Like, are you confident? Do you have presence? We talk about that in like jury psychology. It's like, if you're a lawyer in front of a jury, they need to look to you as the authority in the room. We need that with audiences too. If you're the performer, we need to look to you for authority. If the audience feels like they have more power than you, then you're in trouble, because that means you don't look like you know what you're doing to them. They don't feel comfortable giving you the reins of their entertainment that evening, you know, so they're going to sit back and be analytical and judgy. So we need to have control over the stage, but lose control in the performance. It's, you know, maybe we need different words to talk about this, but one I think is needed. I think you need to control that room, but also be out of control, or be able to be out of control in the performance.
That sounds like some high level stuff. As a matter of fact, you know who comes to mind, and I never really saw a lot of his stuff, but my fiance had the pleasure of working with him this past summer, is Eric Andre, the comedian. I don't know if either of you know who he is. Mm-hmm. He goes apeshit. He used to have his own show, his own talk show called the Eric Andre Show, and would just go crazy. You know, run through the house naked or splash blood. Although maybe, I don't know, maybe that's still controlled. I don't know. I don't want to go too far away, though, from what Sam. I think you're right about short form. I think that's the right amount of out of controlness in a controlled environment. We know that the game, these are the parameters of this specific game. Now, the excitement comes from whether or not the players can execute it well or not, and then we move on. But there's somebody who's calling the show, a host of sorts. I think you're right. People love that exciting energy. Can Wayne Brady make up a song about pineapples on the spot? That's exciting. And that's scary to me.
Yeah, and especially with some of the stuff we've been talking about with, like, the unconscious thinking. You know, a lot of those short-form shows are family-friendly. And, like, I can't even imagine what that's like sometimes, where you're like, okay, I have to let go and be lost in this flow, but like, I can't completely lose it. I have to have some loose control over what I'm saying so that I know I'm not getting into, you know, foul territory, basically. That's interesting.
Also, the idea, guys, of kind of letting go in a show. I'd have to be on stage with people that I really, really, not just trust, but that we all backstage say, let's let this be the let go show. Letting go of expectations, letting go of rules, letting go of what we think should happen. Because sometimes I'll have that want to do something like that. The rest of the team isn't on board. And then it's weird. It doesn't lend itself to like what I would consider quality entertainment. You know, it could be strange. I think you two guys do a good job with that, though. I think you two guys do a good job with, I don't know what the word is, what we're calling that. I want to say real quick, Sam, there's the one show I had on Monday, and there was the Heyday show I had. Jimmy Moyer, who's been a guest on this show, we talked about her having the it factor, whether she agrees with that or not. Sam, she hadn't been on stage since before the shutdown. I don't know how much teaching she's done on Zoom, but really she has been not doing much. She was actually saying, I don't even need to play tonight. I could just watch. But because of some number situation, we needed her to play. I'll do my best. But what I want is, I can't begin to describe the force that she was, Sam. She was what I've been saying. She was a human shotgun blast. I mean, people at the theater were posting about her specifically that night, like on Instagram, like best who's ever done it. And I mean, even the way she hosted the show, she just came out at the top and talked to the audience for a little bit and got that suggestion. Holy shit. I mean, she fired this shot right out of the gate. It changed the trajectory of everything. Any thoughts I had about going into the show, Sam, or any personal goals or what can I do was gone. And I was just holding on to the rocket that is Jamie Moyer. And that was a fantastic feeling. That was fantastic. I just wanted to say that out loud, just kind of share that with the listeners. Like, what an experience from having done a pretty good show earlier in the evening to doing a show that was like one of the best of my life. And by that, I think you quantify that by just the feeling, not jokes said or moves made, but this out-of-body experience that you're just trying to hang on for dear life. What a fantastic feeling. I don't know.
You know, maybe as with almost all things, there's a balance to be had. You know, maybe some performers can be out of control in a moment while others are in control. And that balance creates the successful dynamic where not everybody's in control all the time because that maybe that's too measured, and not everybody can be out of control all the time because that's too chaotic, but maybe it's just a balance. And that's a really, really boring place to land on that. But, you know.
I mean, the question I still have, and that I don't know that I'll ever be able to answer, is what's the difference between, you know, hanging on to a ride on the Jamie Moyer rocket, which I imagine is very fun, right? And you're hopping on board and you are off. And what you're saying, Chris, which is like, when you try to do that, sometimes you feel like people aren't jumping on that rocket, and there's an intangibleness there. And I also don't know how much Jamie would see it that same way on either side, right? If she sees, oh, people aren't jumping on your thing, or like, oh, she's doing this thing and leading everyone. I'd be so curious what you're feeling on the inside versus how it's perceived on the outside, and we'll just never be able to see it the same way.
I mean, that's the question. That's that same line of thinking that I think about with Jamie's success or lack of success in Hollywood, in television, where it's like, why are some people on board with some things and not with others? And like, you know, Jamie is not as famous as she should be, in my opinion, and probably in her opinion. And that's interesting too. Like, why aren't they on board in the auditions? Or I don't know. That's a really interesting thing. And also, well, how I got there, Sam, was like, yeah, how come some people aren't on board with my rocket ship taking off? You know, what is that? And that goes to my own personal stuff of like, well, maybe I just don't have, maybe people don't want to buy a ticket to my ride, which is fine too. I'm starting to find my own people. It isn't a million people. It isn't Coachella. It's an acoustic version at a coffee shop, but some people are there, you know. Ah, fuck. I don't know what anything is. I don't know. Look, I'm having fun. I am having fun. And I'm happy to be on the Jamie Moyer rocket ship, and I'm happy to even try my own stuff when it fucking fails. That's the thing too, at this age and this amount of experience, I'm not worried. There's no panic that sets in. You know, I say my couple lines about how in love I am with this person in this scene, and they're like, are you going to pay for this dinner? And that gets a bigger laugh. And then I'm like, okay, well, all right. I guess no one gives a shit about true love.
Well, you know what I was just thinking is, I think the person having the most fun is the rocket ship. And it's hard, even if you're doing better, more grounded scenes, I think that might lose to who's having more fun.
I don't know, man. I've seen some people have a lot of fun on stage and no one wants to get on board it. You know, like there's such a funny line between like self-indulgent fun on stage and actual shareable fun. I don't know.
Yeah, that's weird too.
Yeah, shareable fun is an interesting concept.
That is interesting. Also, Jamie, when I'm doing what I want to do at the best of my ability, I don't think I'd even call it having fun. Maybe therein lies a problem. I don't think fun is the word I use to describe it.
Well, do you have fun when you're in there?
Again, I don't know if the word is fun.
But I mean, like, there's... this is the Comedy Fix, and Chris has been moving over, and I just love this as a bit, where it's like, you know, I just want to do some, like, dramatic, scripted... It feels like it, but, you know, I'm such a Shakespeare nut. I think there is so much fun people have when they play Macbeth, and they just get to eat up the stage, right? And it's not comedy, but they get lost in this character who gets to storm around and, you know, be violent and kill people and have rageful speeches. And I mean, there are other modes other than just comedy where you can kind of lose yourself into the performance. And, you know, it might not be the easiest thing in the world to find a group of improvisers who want to join you on that journey, but I would love to see that kind of show where it is the Arthur Miller improvised show, and it's a little bit darker and more serious, but you know, those are still such great roles that real actors can kind of sink their teeth into.
Yeah. Yeah. And then I think about the times where I was getting paid to do comedy and have fun. And that's probably the least amount of fun I've ever had in my life, when comedy was the expectation. That feels like torture to me, if I'm being honest. Be it the cruise ships or being that show I did off Broadway, they're both incredible experiences, but I wouldn't call like going for that laugh in front of this house fun. Oof. And maybe that's just me. Maybe that's why I don't do stand-up comedy or something. You know what I mean? That's just like, yikes. Here comes all these people. You know, you get to a place too where you know too much about improv and maybe comedy that you have to like go 7 steps stupider. I'm going to get bad mail for this, to get the general audience to laugh. All right, check this out. I know we're just going on these rants today. That's what this whole podcast is about. I was trying to explain this to Jessica. I don't know if I can do it here, but hear me out. I go, you know what's weird? Some people in our friends group, and I don't mean comedy friend group. College friends, other friends. There are some people that are considered funny in our friend groups. And I was telling Jessica, well, everything they say to me is very easy to say. I don't think they're particularly brilliant jokes. And I don't say them. I don't say that line about dinner with our friends because I don't know how to say this. It's beneath me. Like, that's a very easy joke to make. So I don't make that. But then that person makes that joke and people laugh and they go, that person's funny. Again, this is not with professional comedians. This is just the general public. And that's a weird place where I spend a lot of time when it comes to movies or television, where I go, it's less in movies and television because they're more professional, obviously. But there are times when I go, I'll say it in my head. I'll go, well, this would be the line to say here, but I won't say it because that's like pretty easy. And then I know I'm explaining myself over and over. And then they say it and then they get the laugh. And it's so strange that I'm not considered the funny one. They're considered the funny one because they're saying the thing that would be very easy for me to say because I understand comedy and I understand situations and specificity and everything. This is the only thing I fucking know anything about. So of course I could make a fucking quip about the dumplings and how the pun, the play on words goes with that. But I don't do that because I'm not in elementary school. I'm up here. And I sit here and I wonder if anybody in our friends groups that doesn't do what we do would even consider me funny.
Do you know what I mean? From your elevated comedy, you know, doc professor ivory tower position, what is the funny comment to you about the dumplings? Like, if they gave you the elementary school version, what's your level?
I thought about that.
And then would it be received? Would it be funny?
Well, first of all, I don't think I'm glad you brought this up. Oh, I love you guys because you hear me. I don't have that line. I don't have the funnier version, but some of my friends do. Some of my friends do. I could think of like Tommy Bechtold or Brandon Barrick. We had Brandon on this podcast. These are some very funny people that when they say the line, I go, oh shit, that's the line. That's the line. So I'm not as funny as them. And I don't mean that in a demeaning way. It's like, I don't have the line about the dumplings, but Brandon does, Tommy does. And I think about why other great comedians love other great comedians. You know, Norm Macdonald passed away recently and all these great comedians are saying how important he was to them. And I'm like, yeah, that's my, they understand that he had another level. I don't know. I don't know. That was a great question, Jamie. I'm glad we're talking about this.
There are two sort of responses you'll get in a writer's room. I've seen sometimes where if the same joke is pitched in Cheers, if two people pitch the same joke for a line, they would say, well, someone in the audience will think of that. So we can't do it. We have to come up with a different joke. So that's how they dealt with two at the same time. Other rooms, they might say, that's the joke. two people think that's the line that's supposed to be there. Yeah, that's the line that's supposed to be there. And I think it's interesting that you're kind of catching yourself in this situation where you recognize that that's the line that could be there. A better comedian would come up with a better one, but then you end up not saying anything. So no, you're not the funny one. The person who says the funny thing is the funny one.
Right. And then I started thinking, what if I just started saying it? What if I just started saying the elementary version? I don't think I actually could, but for an experiment, what if I did it? Like, I don't think that would bring me any joy. I don't. Oh, it's,
do you want to be able to have the ivory tower comment about the dumplings? Do you want that, or are you fine not having that?
Well, that's my hell. That's the hell you just described. My hell is that, yeah, I guess I would like to have that. But I don't, and I just know too much to recognize that. And that sucks because I'm in this weird limbo of like, I don't got that, but I'm way better than that. And what do I do with this? You know, what the fuck do I do with this? I think that's the difference. I'm so glad. Listen, people probably stopped listening right by now, but I just so glad we talked about this because I've never been able to put a fine point on that. I think those levels really exist. Oh, and when I hear somebody funny say something really, I go, holy shit, yes, yes. It might not even be laughter. It is laughter, but there's also this like, oh, they cracked the code on that fucking thing. Where everybody else, I'm like, dog, that's just basic arithmetic. But I don't know. Fuck, I'm saying the same things over and over. It's just a weird split. Do you guys ever, you both do comedy. Do you find yourself in the place where you can see Sam? You could see the easy joke, or I don't know. Where do you land there?
I love being the funny guy in the office because in normal office workplaces, people aren't that funny. And I think like everyone kind of thinks their friends are funny, like their friend group is funny. And so I think that's just like everyone's subjective thing. But like in offices, people aren't joking around. Like they just don't. Think of it a lot of times. And I've found that I actually have to do the opposite. I have to be careful with making too many jokes. My jokes can come across as mean. I have to be like careful that I'm not like topping people in social situations or like trying to get the last word all the time. So I'm finding myself just like laughing at people's jokes more. That's my struggle.
Sam, I want to hear your struggle, but Sam, that's the other thing too, is somebody will say something and then I immediately can put in the heightened version of that. I could top them essentially, but I don't want to do that because I'm not here to like slam somebody at Korean barbecue. But like, I could be like, oh, what you, not only could I like heighten that, I could even do yours the way it should have been done. I could even pick the words you use, move them around to show you. Like you're just down here, dog. You don't understand the heightening, Jamie.
I just love the idea of you slamming somebody at Korean barbecue. It's just like, God, what an intense friend you are.
To be like, bam, fucking. What you meant to say was Kim Chi or whatever the fuck, right?
Oh God, that's funny. For me, I don't know. I don't know. I don't socialize with a lot of people. and even when I work from home, so I don't even have an office. So it's interesting. You know, I have self-consciously dumb jokes that I know are so dumb, but I commit so hard to them that I think that's, I can have my cake and eat it too, because normal non-comedian people like it, but the comedians can appreciate the self-deprecating sarcasm of it as well. So I almost feel like maybe I found a nice middle ground, and that's not always. I'm not cracking jokes every other second, but like the comments that I have, I feel like maybe split the difference a little bit.
I need to mention somebody. In Chicago, I worked at a place called the Chef's Catalog, which is a gourmet cookware store, kind of like William Sonoma, Sur La Table. And there's a dude who worked there who became one of my all-time best friends. His name's John Dixon. We call him Dixie, Dixie Dank. John Dixon never trained in comedy and was very, very, very funny. And let me give you an example of something he did one time. I had just kind of met him. He invited me to a barbecue with his friends. So I didn't know anybody in Chicago, really. And at one point, his friends kind of nudge each other and they go, hey, Dixie, do your Beavis and Butthead impression. And he proceeds to do this terrible impression of Beavis and Butthead. And they all start laughing at him. And I'm thinking, oh, this is sad. They're just laughing at this guy. Like, it's kind of mean. And I started to realize, we worked together for years and we came very close. This guy, to me, it's brave, does comedy for himself. He was purposefully doing a bad impression, but they all believed he was doing his best impression that he could and was falling short. And I don't know what this quality is. I don't have the quality to walk away from a situation and not go, just kidding, guys. Or, hey, I'm here too. Hear me out. Another example would be like, he tried to convince one of the ladies, this older ladies that worked with us, that he was going to audition for The Producers, the musical. It was very popular. And he would walk around Chef's Catalog singing, and he had a terrible voice. But this lady desperately believed and was so upset that he was going to audition for The Producers, even though he has a terrible voice. But he never let her in on the fact that he was just kidding. So she would find him in the break room singing loudly, rehearsing, quote unquote. But it's, do you know what I'm trying to say? Like, he would just do these absurd things that people would think, this guy does bad impressions, is a terrible singer, the end. Not this guy knows he's being funny. Not this guy is trying to make us all laugh. That he would put himself at the butt of the joke and then walk away, but he would know it the whole time. Does that make any sense to you guys? To me, I always found that so, I never had the guts to do something like that, to sit in a position where I'd be so vulnerable and people would call me stupid and then like be okay with that and just be like, yeah, cool. I would have to go, wait, time out. I'm just doing my impression of somebody who's being bad. You hear me? I don't know. I want to mention that guy.
Yeah, you come from an honor culture where if you don't have a reputation, you can get physically harmed. So, of course, you believe that it's important that you keep up your reputation as much as possible. And someone like John, who doesn't come from that background, is able to say, doesn't matter what people think of me.
It doesn't matter.
But, like, I've been living outside of a park now for a year.
You okay?
I take my... Huh?
You living outside of a park?
Yeah, like in an apartment building.
Oh,
a park.
Okay. I just didn't know if you were like, you know, living on the street or something else.
No, I'm not. I mean, there are some homeless people in the park, though. Their comedy bits are fantastic. There's this one guy who every morning for like an hour will sit, and it's such a great game because he wants money for a coffee. And he'll be like, hey, how you doing? How's your family? I'm like, oh, they're good. Like, how are you doing? I just want a coffee. He'd be like, hey, man, like, oh, man, what'd you think about the Eagles? I'd be like, oh, yeah, that was a good game. What'd you think about it? He's like, yeah, it was pretty good, but I'd love a coffee. Like, it's just always sort of back to the coffee thing. And I guess what I'm coming to now is appreciating the performances in real life of the games and the bits and
yeah.
The woman in the elevator who gets out and it's not her floor. And so she goes back in realizing that I was waiting for the elevator, but now the doors are closing and now she's gone. And like, it was just like this perfect little moment of a sketch. And I don't know how to replicate that stuff in life. I don't know that I could do the John Dixon thing, but I'm trying to be better about recognizing it because
that's beautiful.
It's all around us.
I think that's beautiful.
I don't have anything to top that. Well, this has been the Comedy Fix. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you guys have any parting thoughts. We're at the Comedy Fix. Some people have been saying on social media they wish that there was a place, a virtual place, I assume virtual, where listeners to the podcast, dare I say fans, may continue the conversation or share their opinions with each other. I want you all to rest assured that we have no intention of doing anything like that at all. You can send us a private message and it will slowly die in our inbox. Anything else from you, Chris, Sam?
On that, you're right. We don't have any intention of putting together a forum. I was thinking, though, as some people have done, they comment under the Facebook posts that I post, or you could comment under one of the six pictures I post for each episode on Instagram, which is at the Comedy Fix. It's a little, it's not a very controlled environment, but if you want to get your thoughts heard or send us that private message, which a lot of people do. Also, last thing I want to say is before we started this podcast, I had a pretty good idea of what I thought improv and performance could be, should be. Then 63 episodes later, that was all completely shattered for the better. And then I thought I was building a new thing recently. And then I stepped on stage and did two shows that were out of my control and completely different. And now I'm back to square one and I love it. I love it here. That's it. Thank you, Sam.
There are a bunch of people on the Instagram post who want us to like share it with records. Do you ever do that? They say like, hey, share this with DMC Records. Do you do that?
No, I should.
You should. I mean, they're asking you nicely.
Yeah, good point. Okay, you know what? I'll start sharing it with them.
All right, so you can find us on DMC Records.
Yeah.
All right, well, hey, this is the Comedy Fix. We're reaching you from square one. Bye-bye.